You're listening to Wisconsin Today.
And earlier this year, Beyoncé's latest album, Cowboy Carter, became the first by a black woman to hit number one on Billboard's country charts.
Country music is often seen as the music of rural white America. But when we dig beyond the stereotypes, the genre owes a lot to African Americans, stretching all the way back to the introduction of the banjo.
And black artists, including Solomon Burke, Tina Turner, and Ray Charles, have all recorded country songs over the years.
Add Milwaukee's Andre Lamar to that list. He recorded and performs as the black country singer. Andre, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you grew up in Milwaukee. Andre, I understand you sang in your church's gospel choir and high school choir. When did you first start to encounter seriously country music?
My first introduction to country music, actually, it was a story that, you know, kind of, I guess, yeah, it's a story. But after high school, I went to Mesmer High School. After high school, I actually went the wrong way and got in trouble with the law and was placed in a situation where the guards, all they played was country music. Growing up in the 53206 zip code, the chances that you're going to hear country music before you're 18 are very slim. So this is my first introduction. I can't say that I was a big fan right away, but I've always been a fan of lyrics and I've always been a fan of storytelling. So that's what hooked me.
I think some people just plain don't like country music, at least at first. Talk a little more about what it was that made you warm up to country music.
First I'll talk about what kind of kept me away. It was some of the sounds that I wasn't used to hearing. Mm-hmm. You know, like the steel guitar or the banjo or, you know, even electric guitar. It's very rare that you would hear that in today's music and, you know, African-American music. So those sounds kind of kept me away from it. And I wasn't used to hearing them. But once I started really focusing in on the stories and hearing how the music flowed with the stories, I think that's what just kind of kept me drawn in. And I love the way the country stories would evoke emotion and make me feel a certain way.
And you're a music guy. What is it that made you say, okay, I like listening to it now. I'm going to try playing something in kind of a country feel.
I've always been a storyteller and I've always been a writer. So it was my first country song that I wrote called High Life, where I started writing the lyrics almost being funny. And, you know, something just clicked in that moment and I finished writing those lyrics and I sang that song for a couple people and everybody enjoyed it and they loved the writing. So that's what made me say, you know what, I can do this. I can pursue this and I can tell stories. You know, there's no difference between the stories. It's just how they're presented.
Well, let's hear a little bit now. This is one of your songs. This is from back in 2014. I've been pretty popular online. The song is called Gone Fishing.
For some reason she seems to please. I'm leaving. There's something I'm missing when I'm gone fishing.
Andre, what was the inspiration behind Gone Fishing?
Gone Fishing is, you know, it's the story of a man who's not paying attention and life is just passing him by. And before he knows it, everything's changed and he doesn't even realize it. And his woman's gone because she's not happy. And, you know, it's just the idea of being gone fishing, you know, when you go to a place and they have the sign on the door that says, I'm gone fishing, mm-hmm. Be back in 10 minutes. But it's the idea that you're not on duty. You're not paying attention to life.
But as I listen to the song, I feel like the guy in the song, he's out fishing. He's still kind of enjoying life despite the bad stuff going on.
Right. Or he's just oblivious to it. So, you know, one thing is to be oblivious to it, and another thing is to be able to smile through it. So, yeah, I agree. But this guy, I think he's more so oblivious to what's going on.
And did you go fishing at some point in your life? Was that part of your story too?
I love fishing. My dad was an avid fisherman, and I grew up fishing. That's how we were raised. So, you know, understanding the whole idea of baiting your hook and throwing it out there and seeing what you get. I love it.
Andre Lamar of Milwaukee is with us. He records as the black country singer. It's no secret, Andre. People think often of country music as white music. Been that way in many ways for decades. What kind of reaction do you get from audiences, black or white for that matter, saying, hey, wait a minute, this is country music. This is a black performer. Does it strike people? Do you get those double takes?
I do. And I still appreciate it even to this day. I've been singing country music for a long time, so I love the fact that it's more popular today than it's ever been. And, you know, but I've been doing it so long that before it was popular, of course, a lot of people would, you know, say, hey, you know, what are you doing singing country music, or how did that happen? There's always the need to want to know why or how. And that's what I always try to kind of break that myth and say, there's no need to know why. It's just what I'm doing. It just is. The same way Eminem can, you know, be the number one selling rap artist of all time.
When I read up on country music history, Andre, it seems like every generation, every decade, there are black country music performers. Black people in America did so many things, like, you know, bring the banjo into the game, so much stuff that made country music happen. Why do you think that this whole genre just became so identified with white performers and white fans?
Well, you would have to honestly pay attention to the industry, because the people who control these sounds are the people who actually, you know, get to control the narrative. So if I'm an artist who never gets the opportunity to be heard, then, you know, but someone else might get more of an opportunity just based on their skin color. And honestly, that's why I went back to school after, you know, going the wrong way and dealing with incarceration. After that is when I decided to get a marketing degree and start my own label, my own publishing, and be able to help other artists as well to discover their voice and be able to place their voice somewhere where it can be heard.
I want to check out another one of your songs. This is a newer one now. It's called Been Around. You released it this year with Steve Hibicki, a producer known as The Sauce. Here's a little taste of The Sauce. Andre, I love the drop here. It's a straightforward country. Then we got some electronic beat. Tell us some more about the song.
I like this song because it came together pretty quick. Steve reached out to me with the idea, and he put the instrumental together, and I approached it with I wanted to really put some emotion into this song, and it was a fun song to do, and I'm looking forward to doing the visuals for it really, really soon.
And as we wrap up, Andre, I mean, we've been talking about country music. You're clearly influenced by a lot of other genres as well. Do we lose something when we just put these like really hard and fast lines saying, you know, that's country, that's pop, that's soul, whatever?
Yes, we definitely lose something, because all music genres have morphed over time. They're not today what they were 10 years ago. So we have to take in the account of evolution, and things are going to change, and we have to be open to it, because as we, as a people, change and we age and the younger ones age, the way they express is going to change. And doesn't mean that the words that they're saying are less important.
Andre, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your music with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate you guys.
That was Milwaukee's Andre Lamar. He performs as the Black Country singer. And speaking of Wisconsin music, a Viroqua songwriter and musician named Tim got in touch with us to recognize the music scene of the Driftless region.
It's a scene, Tim says, that compares favorably to that of much larger cities across the country.
Tim invites us to consider the wide array of live music options in and around Viroqua. A short list of happenings, Tim writes, shows at Pierce Hill Performing Arts, the Historic Temple Theater, Driftless Books and Music, Music in the Parks, Live in Viroqua Concert Series, Driftless Music Festival, Larry Fest Music Festival, and the festivals hosted at Driftless Music Gardens.
Try saying all of that in one breath, Rob Ferret. Tim, that is quite a list. And thank you so much for sharing your point of pride in Wisconsin music coming from this region.
How about you and your neck of the woods? You can share a special part of your community, whether it's music or a festival or some other thing that makes your community great. Get in touch with us right now. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Introduce us to a special part of your community. On Wisconsin Today, a new book with roots in Wisconsin shares the stories of Black women coming together to succeed in higher education.
We see throughout the book, throughout the stories and interviewing with women, it was important to lift our sisters up.
That's coming up on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Starting college can be a daunting experience. Of course, there's a lot to learn in the classroom, but there's also a lot to learn about how campus works and how to succeed in a new environment.
That's true for any new student. It can be an extra challenge for Black women who often face some institutional and social barriers. New research finds that they succeed by building community with one another along the way.
A new book by a Wisconsin author tracks the experiences of over 100 Black women who graduated from college as far back as the 1950s with stories they shared in their own words.
Rochelle Winkle Wagner is a professor of education studies at UW-Madison, author of the new book, The Chosen We, Black Women's Empowerment in Higher Education. And Tangela Blakely Rivas is Associate Professor of Educational Leadership at St. Mary's College of California, graduate of UW-Madison. She's with us to share her experiences and her research contributions to that new book. Tangela, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
And Rochelle, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's a delight to be here.
Let's start with some of the basics. What do the numbers tell us about Black women who attend college in Wisconsin compared to the population as a whole?
That's a great question. I can start with that. So in the state of Wisconsin, 12% of our state identify as Black. And as we look at some of our big institutions, particularly in the University of Wisconsin system, when we look at University of Wisconsin-Madison, for example, only 4% of the population on campus identify as Black. And that's a number that has really plateaued for over two decades. So we really are not yet at the point in our state where we have reached what we would call racial parity in terms of college access.
and Tangela, the book, Rochelle's book, is all about stories of people, of Black women attending college. You came to UW-Madison yourself for a graduate program. Can you talk a little bit about your experience, your oral history, if you will, as a student in Wisconsin?
Sure. I grew up in a mid-sized city in New England. And my story really begins, you know, in the K-12 public education system. And so my high school was located right down the street from an Ivy League institution. And before I graduated, you know, I had questions about why most of my peers, including myself, weren't considering this Ivy League institution for college. You know, the backstory starts there. I leave New England and I have an opportunity to go to Spelman College, which is an HBCU for Black women, which was an amazing space. As a first-generation college student, I moved to Atlanta. I was in this very unique and affirming space, developed lifelong relationships that were very empowering. I had Black professors, Black mentors. And so these spaces were very special and nurturing to me. So fast forward, I leave Spelman, and I would eventually move to the Midwest and move to Chicago. And I start working for a college access organization, which sends students from the city of Chicago, mostly students of color, to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And that was actually my first experience with Wisconsin schools. So working intimately with high school students from Chicago Public Schools who would enroll at the UW as an undergraduate student. And so I saw many of them enroll, graduate, persist, be very successful, and pursue amazing careers and do amazing things in life. And so when it was time for me to make a decision about where I would go for my graduate program, I had already had some familiarity with the UW. And so I applied and the rest is history. And so that is sort of my story to the University of Wisconsin, Madison.
And we'll pick up that story in just a bit. And Rochelle, in this project that leads up to this book, you interviewed 100 Black women with help from Tangela and some others about their experiences at colleges and universities, Wisconsin and around the country. You call it a 10-year labor of love. Tell us a little bit about how this all came together and what you were hoping to accomplish.
The book starts from a simple question where I was really trying to figure out, in a society where a lot of institutions, including colleges and universities, really are just not set up for Black women to be successful, and a lot of these institutions might even be set up in ways that put barriers in place for Black women, in this book I was asking a simple question, and that is, how have they thrived? And we know they have. We know that many Black women are, you know, leading our institutions, leading our country. They are leading communities. And so here I was trying to understand, what is it that they've done to be successful in those ways?
What were some of the key things, Rochelle, that you found that enabled Black women to thrive in college? And a big focus, clearly, if I could spoil it, it's not just about me, it's about we. You found a sense of community.
Yes, that is absolutely right. So the big argument that I saw over and over again across all of the oral histories in this book, five cities and over a 60-year time period, is really a relatively simple answer that might feel profound to a lot of people, and that is that Black women have long understood something that a lot of people have failed to remember, and that is that their liberation is tied to one another. So what we see in this book is that Black women are saying to us and teaching us, and we can learn from this, that I cannot be free unless we all are free. And Black women have been doing this with and for each other for quite some time.
All right, Tangela, let's take us back now to your graduate experience at UW-Madison. As you said, you'd been in Spelman College, felt great support there as an HBCU, historically Black college or university. Take us now into UW-Madison.
Sure. So I enrolled in the University of Wisconsin-Madison, it's hard to believe, 13 years ago. So
I pursued both my master's and PhD in educational leadership and policy studies. And what was important to me when I stepped onto that campus was just building community. And so I found community when I got to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Initially, you know, coming into campus, you know, as a Black woman, not seeing a lot of graduate students who looked like me, I found other Black graduate students at the University of Wisconsin. We found one another. We found one another on campus. And so it was really, really instrumental in building community. In many ways, it was my lifeline that helped me to persist. And so in our community, we would get together. We formed an informal writing group. And so we called ourselves the Writing Warriors, which is a group that exists today. And so that was, a part of building community when I was on campus. We hosted potlucks. We helped prepare one another for academic job talks. And so we organized ourselves and we supported one another and we wrote together. And so, coming to, Wisconsin, not seeing a lot of students who looked like me, like I said, it was very, very important for me to find community.
Both of you talked to, as we mentioned, it ended up being 100 or so Black women in preparing for this book. I'm curious, you mentioned Rochelle. This is going back decades, 50, 60 years. Can you talk a little bit about some of the conversations you had with those people who, I'm guessing in some cases, might have been the first Black woman or among the first Black women on some of the campuses?
Yes. So I think about, as an example, there was a woman in the book who goes by the name of Janelle, and she graduated from the University of Iowa in 1968. So she was on that campus during the, heart of the civil rights movement. She talked about how she went to that campus, University of Iowa, and she moved into a residence hall, and there were 400 people in the residence hall. There were only three other Black women in the entire residence hall. And so she said, something similar to what Tangela was just referring to, which is, we had to find each other. So she made friends with these three other Black women in her residence hall. They became what turned out to be lifelong friends. They joined the same historically Black sorority. They started the Black Student Union that now has served generations of other Black students on that campus at the University of Iowa and supported them. And they engaged in a lot of civil rights activism that really reinforced their own leadership and many of their own careers, as it turned out. I last spoke to Janelle just a couple of years ago. She recently passed away. She was well into her 80s by that time. And the last time I spoke to her, she was still in touch with those friends that she made back in the 1960s at the University of Iowa.
We're talking about the history of Black women succeeding in higher education with Rochelle Winkle Wagner, education policy professor at UW-Madison, and Tangela Blakely Rivas, associate professor of educational leadership at St. Mary's College of California, graduate of UW-Madison. They worked together on the research for this new book we're talking about. It's called The Chosen We, Black Women's Empowerment in Higher Education. Tangela, you mentioned that the Writing Warriors, this group you had with other students, still going today. In the research for this book, did you encounter that a lot where, one generation helped the next or created something, some community that stuck around for future generations?
Absolutely. And I would say, it's part of what we do, uplifting one another, supporting one another. It's the saying that when one of us wins, we all win. And so collectively, we see throughout the book, throughout the stories and interviewing with women, it was important to lift our sisters up. That's what we do, right? So the writing group happened organically. But, it's those spaces, it's those collective, opportunities that, that we create in order to make sure that the experiences of those who were coming behind us have it just a little bit easier.
Rochelle, we've talked a little bit about UW-Madison. You also look at UW-Whitewater in the book. Can you talk a little bit about stories you heard from there and the kind of programs and resources that you found there?
Yes. At the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, while the percentage of Black students remains consistent with University of Wisconsin-Madison, so right around 4% Black students at that institution, there are programs such as the King Chavez program, named after Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez. And these programs provide a career-long support as a student enters college, to provide community, some pro seminars that help students to just see what opportunities are available for them. That example of King Chavez and other programs at University of Wisconsin-Whitewater makes some of the experiences quite different, but also from a University of Wisconsin-Madison, for example, and we could stand to learn from some of these programs.
Tangela, do you see other comparable things that, you know, the universities and colleges themselves could be doing to help Black women, and so that they don't have to just rely purely on finding this community themselves?
Yes, I think that's a really good question. I think, you know, as we sort of think about the social political context that we're in right now, there's so much harm and frankly violence that's being done to Black women, to Black men. And these experiences and challenges are traumatic for all of us, for our college students, for our graduate students, and they're bringing these challenges and trauma with them to campus, right? And so it's important that institutions recognize the social political context that we're in. Institutions could also do a better job at making sure diversity, equity, and inclusion are central and a priority. And so that's what I would say in terms of what institutions can do.
Rochelle, diversity, equity, and inclusion, political targets now here in Wisconsin and in the rest of the country, university funding in part linked to debates over that. What would you say to people listening who might say, well, DEI, that's what we're trying to get rid of, right? What would you say to make the case?
You know, The Chosen We, the book that we're talking about, teaches us that no students will ever be fully supported or educated until all students are. It's the idea, as I said earlier, I cannot be free unless we are all free. Black women have long understood this, that their freedom and liberation is bound to one another. And what I'm seeing in this book and what I'm arguing here is that we can use Black women's experiences in higher education as a bellwether for the entire system of higher education. So what, to say it more clearly, if we support Black women in higher education, we will in turn be supporting all students.
And there's a phrase in the book, well, there's kind of a story, I think, Tangela, like, oh, this Black woman, adversity, and she rose above it through strength of character, et cetera, a superwoman. And we celebrate that story in the book. I think some of the stories come out and say, well, wait a minute. Why can't we have it so you don't have to be a superwoman to get through in the first place? Do you have some thoughts on that?
I do. You know, there's this narrative that Black women have it all, right? That that we can, you know, show up in all areas of our life and succeed. And so there's this inherent pressure to perform. And that's not the case. You know, Black women are suffering. And we need support. You know, we cannot do it all. And so it's important that that's acknowledged. It's important that there are supports and structures and systems to take the pressures away, you know, so that we're not in this position to have to perform and to show up.
And Rochelle, the book title, The Chosen We, the book specifically about Black women in higher education. If I'm reading you right, the concept of The Chosen We, that we can all be more successful if we help each other out, I get the sense you're making the case that, well, this isn't just about Black women in college.
we can indeed learn from Black women over time who, you know, I certainly am not the first to say that Black women have been and should and continue to be elevating each other. Black feminist theorists and thinkers have been saying that for 150 years. What I am saying here is that often Black women are supporting and elevating each other in the absence of societal and institutional support. And so what I think we can learn from this is that we can better offer support to Black women societally and institutionally so that they aren't the only ones supporting each other and themselves. And we can learn across racial groups that this important lesson, which is that we really are bound up in each other's freedom and in each other's liberation. And I think if we move into that kind of thinking, we move away from educational and social institutions that keep asking, what am I owed? What do I get out of this? Instead, we start to ask, what do we owe each other?
I will leave it there. Rochelle, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's really a joy to be here.
And Tangela, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That was Rochelle Winkle-Wagner, professor of education studies at UW-Madison, and Tangela Blakely-Rivas, educational leadership professor at St. Mary's College of California, graduate of UW-Madison. They're with us to talk about their contributions to a new book. It's called The Chosen We, Black Women's Empowerment in Higher Education. It shares the stories of 100 Black women who attended college since 1954, what we can learn from their experiences overcoming obstacles and creating community.
Ahead on Wisconsin Today, a Milwaukee food program works to meet the cultural needs of refugees.
You're in a whole new culture, and to integrate into a whole new culture, trying to provide these familiar things such as food is something so important.
That's up next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Wisconsinite and his love of cars.
Summertime in Milwaukee is more than beer gardens and beach parties. It's also cruising season, where people bring out their favorite cars. Eric Ramos from the south side of Milwaukee has grown up in the culture, specifically the lowrider culture. As Jimmy Gutierrez tells us, Ramos is helping that scene grow.
60 Impala, 80 DeVille, Cadillac. It's the baddest Cadillac in the south side.
This is Eric Ramos.
Three-wheel king. The black and gold don't fold.
He's pointing out a few lowrider favorites at the World of Wheels, Milwaukee's first car show of the year. For this show, Eric brought out his baby, as he calls it. It's his 35 Packard. Think any Prohibition-era gangster movie. It's got an oversized chrome grille, wave-like side panels, and a velvety navy blue paint job. Altogether, there are 20 to 25 lowriders here today. And that number, like Milwaukee's lowrider scene, is growing.
The lowrider scene, I think, is bad. In the last 15 years, easily, it's changed.
While lowriders are having a moment in Milwaukee, Ramos says a lot of that scene today can be traced back to one club in the early 90s.
Bajitos. You had Bajitos shop right there on 6th and Orchard.
Ramos grew up down the block and remembers there wasn't much else at the time.
But as we grew up, I think it was our generation that blew it up.
Another major change at that time was the introduction of Lowrider magazine. It was the Vogue, or GQ for street culture, featuring the baddest rides from coast to coast. And at the end of each printing was an ad section where riders in places like Milwaukee could finally find parts they've been searching for. The problem wasn't where to find the parts, but how much to spend on them.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hundreds of thousands from buying cars, parts, adding to them. I mean, you get a car, what do you do? Rims, radio, hydraulics.
Car culture has been a family affair for Ramos. Uncles, cousins, friends got him hooked. And his parents hoped that it would keep him out of trouble.
They knew, like, this little f***er's gonna, you know, we gotta make sure we keep him busy.
They tried. But besides being drawn to cars, Ramos was also drawn to the streets.
I mean, why sugarcoat it? Yeah, I was a gangbanger. I was a drug dealer. I was a criminal.
After prison, he retired from gangbanging in the early 2000s. He knows that not everyone can walk away as easily as he did. And that's when he dove headfirst into the lowrider scene. It didn't take long for other riders to invite him out to car shows or to just go cruising. Exactly what he needed.
You know, these guys are not dealing. These guys are not gangbanging. These just, you know, some of these guys already have families.
Ramos ended up joining a car club, and it brought a lot of things he was familiar with in gang life, camaraderie, structures, but also some bad politics. So after a while, he and a group of guys branched off and started their own club in Milwaukee, Ranflitas.
They used to say the Ranfla. So the homies back then, the Zoot Suiters or whatever, you know, here comes the ride. In reality, that's what it means, the ride.
While the Milwaukee chapter is modest, 5 to 7 riders, it's a nationwide club. And their impact in Milwaukee is as large as a G-body. They've organized neighborhood cleanups, food and coat drives, picnics, and changed the narrative of who's behind the wheel. Ranflitas has also started their own car show, El Grito, which turned 5 last year, and its biggest event yet.
We seen that 5th Street was getting gentrified. 5th Street was all restaurants, tortillerias. It was a Latino thing, you know what I mean? It was all raza businesses there. And we started seeing the changes, like, man, we got to do something just to let the newcomers know where they're at. Not being as, but, you know what I mean? Keep the tradition. Let it be known, like, hey, okay, to you guys, it's new, but we've been here.
Thousands of people took over South 5th Street in Walker's Point. There was music, vendors, traditional Aztec dancers, all just a block away from where it all started in Milwaukee. And that's what this is all about. Keeping the culture growing and thriving.
Jimmy Gutierrez is a reporter based in Milwaukee. He brought us that story on Eric Ramos and the lowriders of the city. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Wisconsin is a new home for refugees from countries like Syria, Afghanistan, and Burma, where people have fled persecution and war.
Among the many challenges for these refugees is finding food that meets their Muslim dietary guidelines. A refugee aid organization in Milwaukee aims to boost access to that food.
The Hanan Refugees Relief Group recently received a cultural food advocacy grant. They plan to use it to expand their cultural food programs and to raise awareness of the needs of refugees and immigrants in Milwaukee.
Sheila Badwan is executive director of Hanan Refugees Relief Group. Sheila, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you talk, before we get into this new grant, can you talk about the work that the Hanan Refugees Relief Group has been doing already, especially when it comes to food programs for refugees and immigrants in the Milwaukee area?
Yes. Hanan has been a community-based organization for the last 7 years in Milwaukee, servicing refugees and immigrants. And food is one of our programs that we have seen that is really needed among this population. So we actually have many different events throughout the year that pertain to food. We have a Ramadan food box event that usually happens early in the year where we provide food for to all refugees in the month of Ramadan for 30 days. We also have a Qurbani event, which is a meat distribution event. And then we are a new resettlement agency. So we actually have to provide one of our core services is providing welcome groceries to newly arrived refugees. So these are just some of the areas that we work with, but we have seen a high need of
refugees that do not know where to purchase cultural foods and have seen in these 7 years that we have grown, just really trying to focus on how can we best serve the populations that are coming in, especially refugees that are coming from Muslim countries that only eat certain meats.
And that takes us right to this new grant, a cultural food advocacy grant. What is this going to help you do?
We're a refugee resettlement agency, and we really, as we expanded, we've actually have brought in almost 250 refugees. Most of the refugees are coming in from Malaysia, Bangladesh, and Thailand, and these particular areas have high numbers of Rohingya refugees, Burmese refugees that are Muslim, and Wisconsin actually has the largest Rohingya population in the U.S. And so we felt like we really needed someone, as we experienced, we felt like we really needed someone to be able to provide education to these refugee clients that come in, kind of help them navigate the food environment, show them where the halal stores are in Wisconsin, in the Milwaukee area, and also educating them on how to use their food share cards. A lot of these refugees don't know how to budget their food share cards to last them a month. Sometimes we've seen experience families that will use up their food card in 1 week. We also have a partnership with Hunger Task Force. We are a designated food pantry, halal food pantry. They have been wonderful partners over the years. Every Friday, we actually have seen a high number of refugees come in and that have finished their food share cards, so they can actually pick up a food box here at our site.
Can you talk about halal a little bit for people who aren't familiar with it? What are the food requirements there? Why is it important to meet that need?
Yeah, so halal is an Arabic word, means it translates to permissible. Many of the Muslim refugees that come in from countries, they will only eat halal, and it's a certain way where meat is slaughtered. They have to say specific sayings. And so that's actually, we have refugees from Afghanistan, from Syria, from Iraq, from Rohingya refugees, Burmese refugees that are Muslim. And this is the first thing they ask us is, where can we buy halal meat? They're very strict about it. It's a Islamic dietary law. So we do have a list of what we've developed internally is a list of resources for the people that need to purchase halal meat. We do a lot of education internally. However, we really needed someone to be able to, a specific person, just a new role for this, to be able to assist, not just with this particular piece, but really overall all the food environment.
Sheila, thinking about this, so this is a refugee would be somebody who had to leave their home country, went through a long process of applying for refugee status, a lot of hoops to jump through, now in a strange and very different place. When you work with people, what does it mean for them to get this food that they're familiar with, that meets their needs, that meets their religious laws to eat? How on a personal level, how does this affect people?
You know, they're so grateful. I mean, you're in a whole new culture, and to integrate into a whole new culture, trying to provide these familiar things such as food is something so important. Some people didn't even know there was halal. I mean, they weren't even sure if there was actually, if they're able to find meat that was halal meat, or even just cultural appropriate foods. I had many Syrian refugees didn't know if they had, Middle Eastern stores to purchase certain spices or things of that nature. So it really does help in the integration when families come in to know that, there are places that might be familiar for them. And so trying to help them really get adjusted, this is just one piece.
Talking to Sheila Badwan, executive director of Hanan Refugees Relief Group in Milwaukee. New grant is going to help them expand their food available for refugees in the Milwaukee area. Culturally appropriate food, as we've been hearing. Sheila, as you just mentioned, this is one step, this familiar food. What are some of the other big needs out there for the refugees you're working with?
A lot of these families don't understand how to renew their food benefits. And that's an area that one of the core services we have to provide as a resettlement agency is culture orientation. We touch briefly on food share. However, this particular role, this new job position that we are hiring for, will be able to kind of expand and really go in depth of food share, how to understand food share benefits. Also, a lot of mothers are not familiar with WIC. And so being able to provide a space for these families and being sensitive to their needs to provide this education is really important. And so education is a big thing that we are planning to do. And also we are taking families and showing them where the grocery stores are, teaching them prices of where to buy. You know, it might be where they go to their local grocery store and just buy the meat from the Middle Eastern stores. Sometimes you can find at the local grocery store, a bigger grocery store, it might be cheaper to purchase items. So helping them understand how to budget the money and have it out for about a month. And we've worked with hundreds of families and we found that this position is really needed. So we're excited. We're really excited. We're grateful for our partnership with the Greater Milwaukee Foundation.
Sheila, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Sheila Badwan is executive director of Hanan Refugees Relief Group in Milwaukee.
Earlier this week, we checked out a Facebook group that has almost 50,000 members in it, and it shares these restaurant recommendations in Dane County and beyond.
We got an email from Patty afterward who wanted to make a plug for the spring green food scene and a website that helps bring the community together.
Here's what Patty writes. We have a vibrant food scene in the spring green area. We'd love for more people to know about it. A group of small local farmers and food processors, they've gotten together with food retailers and restaurants who use local products. And Patty goes on to say, it's a very cool community of people who love what they do, and we offer classes and events and a webpage that highlights all of our members. You can find out more at Savor the River Valley.
Find that online, and meanwhile, keep your comments coming our way. We love to hear from you about cool things going on in your community that you want recognized, or your reactions to what we talk about here on the show and what it means for your community. You can email us anytime, wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Migration season is picking up in Wisconsin. There will be lots and lots of birds making their way through the state over the next few weeks.
And on Monday, we'll hear from a Wisconsin group that's working to make birding more friendly and more accessible to everyone.
Now we want to hear from you. Are you a birder, hardcore or casual? What's your favorite bird to spot, especially this time of year? Do you have some feathered friends at the feeder right outside your window?
Send us an email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can call or text us at 888-642-0232. Rob, what are you seeing out there?
Of course, sandhill cranes by the place where I go swim. There's a family that hangs out there. And we saw a green heron, which I didn't know was a thing. My wife identified it. I'm not really good at bird IDs. How about you?
You know, I just love looking out the window and at our tree there and see what's fluttering inside and out. It's great.
Excellent. Again, share your local bird report. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.